interaction. It's not that we can turn that on and off. It's just that in traditional metals, all of that complexity that's introduced by the interactions can be hidden away in the innards of weakly interacting quasiparticles. And that traditional picture works especially well in systems in which the highest occupied bands are constructed from S-type orbitals. Whereas if I have a system in which the highest occupied orbitals have a strong D or F character, the small physical size of those orbitals makes it harder for the electrons to avoid each other, making interactions much more important. So the transition metal oxides are systems that have bands of this type, and they display all kinds of interesting behaviors, the most obvious of which is high-temperature superconductivity in the cuprates, but there's also colossal magnetoresistance in the manganites, and there's multiferroic effects, and there's thermoelectric effects, and there's all kinds of interesting things going on. And we'd like to understand those. These materials also often are disordered, either intrinsically or because they're doped. Because very often, to get these interesting behaviors, you're actually doping them. So you're introducing disorder with the doping. And the question of how disorder affects strongly correlated systems is just poorly understood. One of the things that we know disorder does in a lot of systems is to create zero bias anomalies. So what's a zero bias anomaly? Basically, generically, it's some feature in the density of states that's pinned to the Fermi level. But that would appear to include things like gaps in the spectrum due to superconductivity or charge density wave order. And the term is usually reserved for systems in which there isn't a broken symmetry, and in particular systems in which there's disorder. Okay. So the main message of this talk is that zero bias anomalies can happen for quite a range of different reasons. And by studying them, we can learn things about the interactions in the system in which we find the zero bias anomaly. So this is a theory talk, but in principle, it should help us to connect and learn things about interactions in the materials we're interested in. I'm going to begin by providing some background. I'm going to talk about what's known about disorder in zero bias anomalies in weakly correlated metals, and then at the opposite extreme, the atomic limit. And then I'm going to turn my attention to the Anderson-Hubbard model, which is the simplest model, which includes all of the ingredients. And I'm going to begin by showing you that numerical results show that there's a zero bias anomaly that has some interesting characteristics. Now, the thing about numerical results is they're sort of like experiments. They tell you something can happen, but they don't come with a little dialogue box that says why it's happening. So that's been one of the things we've focused on, and I'm going to try and present to you a simple physical picture for part of why that anomaly is taking place. And then I'm going to talk to you about some of the thoughts we've had on the temperature dependence of that anomaly, and also what happens to that anomaly when the interactions are not purely local but extended in range. So let's get started. If I have a system in which the single particle density of states is smooth at the Fermi level, and I add either disorder or interactions, generally nothing happens within certain limits. But if I have both of them, then I can get a zero bias anomaly, both disorder and interactions. And one limit that's been studied extensively is the limit of weak disorder and weak interactions. Altshuler-Aronoff showed, using diagrammatic perturbation theory, that you get a little cusp in the density of states at the Fermi level. And this is due to the interactions, interference between Friedel oscillations coming off of different impurities. But there's a way of thinking about it that I find nice and intuitive. If you imagine that you have two sites with two different potentials, and then you allow hopping between those two sites, the levels are going to be pushed apart. There's going to be level repulsion. If I have a nearest neighbor interaction in that system, and I treat it within a mean field approach, what that nearest neighbor interaction does is basically to renormalize the hopping between those two sites, to increase it. But it only does that between sites in which one of the sites is below the Fermi level and one is above the Fermi level. And it's because of that that you generate a suppression of the density of states, a moving of weight away from the density of states, from the Fermi level. Okay, so that's weakly correlated systems. Well, if I go to the atomic limit, I'm definitely in the strongly correlated limit because my interactions are much stronger than my hopping, which is zero. So the atomic limit has also been studied by Efrosh and Shklovsky, and they have a very cute argument, which is based on the starting point that if I have 1 over r interactions between my electrons, and they're sitting on a disordered set of sites, the site potentials are disordered, in the ground state, the energy to move one of those electrons has to be greater than zero. So that's an inequality. And you can go from that inequality to show that, therefore, the density of states has to be less than, and by a separate argument, actually equal to the energy relative to the Fermi level to the power d minus 1. So what you get is an actual zero in the density of states. So it's called a soft gap, where the power law dependence of the density of states away from that depends on dimension. And I'm showing one for 2 dimensions because I'm going to show you a fair number of 2-dimensional things. So there's been a fair amount of theoretical and experimental work on the crossover between these two regimes in weakly correlated systems. And what I'm showing here is conductance data, tunneling conductance data on beryllium films, so 2-dimensional systems. And these are different curves with different sheet resistances. And the idea is that sheet resistance is telling us something about disorder. The lowest curve here has the highest sheet resistance, so the highest disorder. And you can see that the linear behavior is consistent with Efrosh-Shklovsky behavior for a 2-dimensional system. And then as I reduce the sheet resistance, reducing the disorder, I move towards an Altschul and Aronoff type of cusp. So then you ask, well, what happens when I do the same type of experiments in strongly correlated systems? And those experiments have been done. And essentially, the answer is that the results are confusing. Really, neither of these two limits is seen, and we don't understand it very well. So from a numerical, a theoretical point of view, a useful place to start is the Anderson and Hubbard model, because it has a lot of the 3 main ingredients we need. We have the motion of electrons. This is a tight binding model, so this is hopping between neighboring sites, T. I have an on-site Coulomb repulsion U. And then I have my site potentials are chosen from a random distribution. In this case, we choose a uniform distribution that has a width delta. So if I take away the disorder, so all the sites are the same potential, this is just the Hubbard model. And at half filling, I have a mod insulator. So I have a gap in the single particle spectrum due to the interactions between electrons. On the other hand, if I take away the interactions, what the system does when I have sufficiently strong disorder is to become an Anderson insulator, in which the density of states itself doesn't actually change very much, but the states themselves become localized, starting at the band edges. So the study of both of those axes and their vicinity have very long history, and the part of this that we understand the least is out here where we have strong disorder and strong interactions. So the next question I want to ask is, what does the density of states look like for this system? And what I'm showing here are numerical determinant quantum Monte Carlo and exact diagonalization results by the group of Richard Scalatar at UC Davis. So these are the density of states as a function of energy, and each curve is for a different disorder level. And you can see the black curve on the left here is showing the Mott gap. And then as I increase the disorder, the Mott gap is sort of filling in. But what happens on the right, you can see that as I increase the disorder even further, this gap doesn't finish, this little anomaly doesn't finish filling in, which is the first indication that this isn't just a remnant of the Mott gap. A much more convincing proof that it's not just a remnant of the Mott gap is the fact that if I dope it away from half filling, it also remains consistently there, looking just the same. So this is interesting for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is simply the fact that there's an anomaly at all is very different from the 2 things I told you about earlier. In both the Altshuler-Aronoff case and in the Efrosh-Glaski case, I needed to have non-local interactions in order to see a suppression of the density of states. And here I have purely local interactions, and I'm getting a suppression of the density of states. Well, if you're familiar with the Hubbard model, you know that the combination of the hopping and the interaction U does create an effective non-local interaction called J, the exchange interaction, which is proportional to T squared over U. So you might then expect that this anomaly was proportional to T squared over U. And it turns out that, in fact, it's proportional to T. I don't have space for all the pictures. That anomaly has a width which is proportional to the hopping T and doesn't depend on U or on the interaction or on the filling. So that's pretty curious, and we'd like to understand it better. Okay, so one of the places we're dealing with a very strongly disordered system. Disorder reduces the importance of kinetic energy in a system, and a useful starting point is the atomic limit. So I want to talk about the density of states and the atomic limit of this model. But the short answer is there's no zero bias anomaly here. Nonetheless, it's going to provide us with a little bit of useful context. It's important, if you're used to thinking of density of states in non-interacting systems, it's important to get used to the idea that the density of states changes depending on your filling in a system with interactions. So just to get you thinking about that, if I have a state in which the energy of that, the site potential on that site is higher than the chemical potential, then there will be no particles in the ground state. And the contribution this site will make to the density of states will just be at one energy. It'll be at the site energy. So that's adding one particle. On the other side, if I have a site for which the site potential plus U is less than the chemical potential, then that will be doubly occupied in the ground state, and it will contribute to the density of states only at the energy epsilon plus U for removing a particle. If the chemical potential falls between the site energy and the site energy plus U, then it's going to be singly occupied in the ground state, and I'm going to have contributions to the density of states at the site energy and at the site energy plus U, each with half the weight that these two peaks from the zero and the two sites had. So if I then put together an ensemble of systems of this type, I can get a density of states that looks like this. So each of these sites' energies will be chosen from my random distribution uniform with delta, and I can get a density of states that looks like this. Notice that my contribution from the empty sites, the sites that are empty in the ground state are here, doubly occupied down here, and then I have contributions from singly occupied sites, the lower Hubbard orbital and the upper Hubbard orbital. And this is for half filling, and this is what happens when you move away from half filling. This is a very characteristic form of a sort of a wedding cake with a central plateau and shoulders. Okay, but there's no zero bias anomaly. So how is it that by adding hopping, I'm creating a zero bias anomaly? Well, in order to answer that question, I want to go to a system that has two sites. And once again, these two sites are going to be chosen, the site potentials should be chosen from some random distribution. And we've done a calculation, it's nice and simple, of the density of states of an ensemble of these two site systems, and it turns out that you do get a zero bias anomaly. So what I'm showing here is the density of states as a function of energy focused in on the Fermi level, so this is sort of sitting at the top of my central plateau in my wedding cake. And you can see that as I increase my hopping T from zero, where it's flat, to larger and larger values, I open a zero bias anomaly, which is linear in T. And it turns out also that the width of this anomaly doesn't depend on U, and it doesn't depend on disorder, and it doesn't depend on doping within certain limits. Now, I'm not capturing everything with this little two-site model. I don't have the long length scales that would allow me to get to the very low energies. So I don't see a V shape. This has a flat bottom that it develops. But on the other hand, the fact that the behavior of the width of this anomaly is the same as the behavior of the width of the anomaly in the lattice system that was studied numerically suggests that we are getting the right short length scale physics. And it's so simple, this two-site system, that I can really point to exactly what's causing the anomaly to take place. And condensing that analysis, picking apart the different transitions which are relevant, it turns out that really the fundamental physics is this. If I have a pair of sites in which one of the sites has an energy much lower than the chemical potential, and the other site has an energy just below the chemical potential, but very close to it, in the ground state, this will have one electron on each site in the atomic limit. When I add hopping, the first electron will still sit mostly on this site. But with hopping, the second electron can significantly lower its energy by spreading itself over those two orbitals. And so what's happening here is that lowers the energy of the ground state. The contribution to the density of states comes from the energy difference between the ground state and the excited states. The three-particle excited state and the one-particle excited state, their energies don't change to first order in the hopping. They change to second order, but they don't change to first order. So by lowering the energy of the ground state and not changing the others, I'm increasing the energy of that transition. I'm moving states away from the Fermi level. So I call this a kinetic energy-driven zero-bias anomaly. It's caused by the ability of the system to lower its kinetic energy by spreading the second electron over that site. Okay, so one of the things that I wanted to add in passing is that this type of two-site system has been extensively studied experimentally in the form of double quantum dots, which are of interest for as possible use for qubits. And it turns out that the spin qubits seem to have longer coherence times and work better than charged qubits, so people have sort of in the quantum computing world have moved on. But I would really like to get an experimentalist. There must be people out there with data that they could analyze in exactly this way and see the density of states anomaly that I'm talking about for this system. And I'm especially interested in that because we've also been thinking about the temperature dependence. I thought a number of people asked me when I put this out, well, what's the temperature dependence? Does it just get wiped out by temperature? Well, it's really quite funny because when you add temperature to a strongly correlated system, you actually develop a zero bias anomaly where there wasn't one in the atomic limit. So what I'm looking at here is the atomic limit at finite temperature. This is the density of states as a function of energy again. I don't focus on the top here. This is the half filling, and as I go down, I'm looking at different filling levels. So at the lowest temperature, so these are different increasing temperatures I come down here. The lowest temperature, I have no zero bias anomaly because in the atomic limit, there's no zero bias anomaly. And then when I increase the temperature, I actually develop this little dip in the density of states. And when I turn up the temperature much farther, it becomes flat again because I go to the high temperature limit of a sort of big rectangular density of states. But this is pretty cute, and we can understand it. Basically, what's happening is that a bunch of states, there are little sites up here just above the chemical potential that at zero temperature were empty and contributed to the density of states just there. But when I increase the temperature, some of them become thermally occupied, and therefore half their contribution to the density of states goes from being at this energy to being at this energy plus U. And so I'm moving density of states well out to the edges of my density of states. And the same thing happens on the other side, that I have sites that were previously doubly occupied becoming singly occupied, and again the weight gets shifted away. So what then happens when I add hopping to this system? Well, what's cute is basically the two anomalies just add to each other. I have my kinetic energy driven anomaly, and I have this thermally driven anomaly. And the kinetic energy driven anomaly that I talked about first comes primarily from sites which are singly occupied in the atomic limit, whereas the thermally driven one comes primarily from sites that are either empty or doubly occupied in the atomic limit. And so they're independent of each other, and they basically add together. And then as I turn up the temperature further, the occupation of each site becomes less and less related to what the potential of the site is, and you lose it eventually. But this is a cute effect, and I want to emphasize how very different this is from a weakly interacting system. In a weakly interacting system with a purely local interaction, first of all, I would expect actually a peak in the density of states, a small peak in the density of states at the Fermi level. And then if I increase the temperature, that just gets washed out. Whereas here, I have a suppression in the density of states, and it's actually increased by the increasing temperature. And that's because in a weakly interacting system, each site can contribute to the density of states only in the vicinity of one energy, whereas in a strongly correlated system, each site can contribute to the density of states in, at most, two different energies, which are quite different, quite spread apart. And that difference in energy is fundamentally important to both the kinetic energy-driven anomaly and the thermally-driven anomaly in slightly different ways. Okay, so 5 minutes? Okay. So the last topic that I'd like to turn to briefly is the question of what happens to this anomaly when we allow the interactions to be beyond just local interactions. So I'm going to consider here the extended Anderson-Hubbard model in which I add a nearest neighbor interaction between the sites. And what I'm going to be showing you now are exact diagonalization results on 12-site clusters done using Lanczos. Okay. So this is, again, the density of states as a function of energy. And I've fixed the local interaction and the disorder strength, and this is at half filling. And I'm looking at increasing the nearest neighbor interactions. I want to focus first on these three blue curves. The dark blue curve at the top is just the Anderson-Hubbard model zero bias anomaly that we've been talking about. As I increase V, you can see that the sort of there's a little bit of a remnant of the wedding cake shape with a central plateau and shoulders. And V is going to slightly shift that central plateau wedding cake shape. But the thing I want to draw your attention to is the fact that this zero bias anomaly gets broader. It keeps pretty much the same shape, this nice V shape, but it becomes broader. And we can understand that in the same language that we understood the Altshuler-Aronoff anomaly at the beginning. If I have a nearest neighbor interaction and I treat it within mean field, it renormalizes the hopping between sites. It increases the hopping, the T. So if this anomaly is proportional to T, and I have a renormalized T, which is T plus V, that's what's happening down here. This anomaly, the brighter blue one, has a width which is T plus V rather than just T. But you can see, if I turn up V further, something completely different takes place. Okay, so we can understand the first curves, but something else is happening when I have V get bigger. And to understand that, it's useful to look at sort of the parameter space we're in. Here's the local interaction and the nearest neighbor interaction. In a clean, two-dimensional, extended Hubbard model, we expect to have a first-order phase transition between charge density wave order over here and spin density wave over here with a divider at U equals 4V. When I add disorder, one place that's a useful reference is this axis with U equals 0. Basically, the V is trying to drive the system into a charge density wave with two electrons on one site and then no electrons and then two electrons on the next in an atomic limit picture. And then the disorder is going to mess that up. It turns out that in the atomic limit at U equals 0, there's a very nice analogy to the random field Ising model where the V is like the spin interaction J in the random field Ising model. And the disorder of the site potentials is like the disorder of the field in the random field Ising model. And that's been well studied. And there's this competition between these two effects. But it turns out that in two dimensions, the disorder wins. And there isn't charge density wave order, or there isn't order, spin order there. There wouldn't be charge density wave order for ours. But the size of the domains gradually increases as V increases. So now let's go back to the data that I was showing you. And the white dots now on this parameter space are showing you the positions of these curves. So my first three blue curves are all in this blue region in which the system, the clean system, has spin density wave order. And then when I get to the red curve, I've moved across into this region where I'm expecting charge density wave order that then is being disordered by my disordered site potentials. What happens when I get to the green curve is basically that the size of the domain of my charge density wave order that's disordered on larger length scales, the size of the domain becomes larger than my little plaquette. And so I appear to have seen charge density wave order, and hence I have a charge density wave gap. So you can see that a little bit more clearly when you look at the charge and spin correlations. These are the spin correlations and the charge correlations. And removing increasing V going from here to here. And what's happening is that I'm going from having antiferromagnetic order at this side to losing that on this side and having no charge order and gaining charge order over here. And you can see that the inflection point on these curves comes at about 2, which is, these were curves for U equals 8, so indeed it's happening at the U equals 4V transition. So the last thing that I wanted to look at that's sort of interesting is to then keep V fixed and look at what happens as I increase U going across. And there's really at least 3 different behaviors that I'm seeing in at my density of states near the Fermi level. Down here, I have this very broad V that seems to be characteristic of having charge density wave order that's being frustrated by disorder that's being added to the system. Up at this end, I have the Mott gap. And then over here, I have this narrow V-shaped anomaly that we think is this kinetic energy-driven anomaly that's then enhanced by the nearest neighbor interactions. I want to note that right here, this point, when V is 0, we get a transition to the Mott state at about U equals delta. But when we have this V, it actually seems to push the Mott transition over to the right to higher U values because this is this curve and we don't see the Mott gap yet there. There it is. Delta is equal to 12 here. So there's a number of things that I don't fully understand about this. This curve, this point here is to the left. It would seem to be in the charge density wave region, and yet it's got quite a narrow shape. So there's some things that we'd like to understand better. We've done also some work away from half filling, and basically as I change the filling, I lower the filling, the gap remains pretty much the same, which is what you would expect from our kinetic energy driven picture. And then over here, you can see at quarter filling, as I increase V, I don't get a signature of the charge density wave order because although charge density wave order is happening there, instead of being a 2-0-2-0 order, it's a 1-0-1-0 order, which has a very different feature in the density of states and interacts very differently with the disorder. Okay, so with that, I will conclude by saying we have been thinking about the zero bias anomaly in the Anderson hybrid model, and we have a picture that understands at least the short range, higher energy physics of that zero bias anomaly in a sort of simple physical way. And we found that there's some pretty interesting temperature dependence, even in the atomic limit there. And we're starting to explore what happens when you extend the range of those interactions. And my main point is that zero bias anomalies can tell us about the interactions in the material that we're studying. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, we can take some questions.
It's very interesting work. There is some recent work by Lev Yaffe and Marcus Mueller where they, 2 or 3 years ago, they re-examined the old Efrosklowski argument. And they claim that it's rigorous, or vigorous, depending. It's a physics argument, after all. That is correct in the regime where there is some sort of spin glass or Fermi glass behavior. They make an analogy with a spin glass. Mm-hmm. And they show that these usual shapes that you were discussing for the zero bias anomaly, they can be derived with some confidence when you have some replica symmetry breaking or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. So I think that should be certainly relevant to one of your regimes where interactions and disorder are simultaneously strong.
Absolutely. I think one of the things that's difficult about the Efrosklowski argument specifically is it really only works when you have infinite range interactions. And because we're interested in the shorter range interactions, you run into trouble. Yes. But there is an interesting thing. If you go to the shortest range, the nearest neighbor interactions, you get charge density wave order. If you go out to Efrosklowski, that's not what you have. So somewhere in between, there was some trade-off between the Afrashkovsky behavior and the tendency to charge order.
But the point is that it should be some kind of glassy state.
Absolutely.
Usually when people analyze this only in terms of the zero bias anomaly, you don't focus on that. But in fact, there is, I think, some data from a group in Israel.
Okay.
I forgot what material this is. It's a heavy disordered semiconductor where they see characteristics, spin glass type behavior with memory effects and so on.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Okay, well, let's thank Rachel again.